Hi, you're listening to Great Thinking, Ideas and Conversations from Greenbelt. We're Greenbelt. We're somewhere to believe in.
Over to you.
Thank you so much. I'm absolutely chuffed to be here. Really, really exciting. I actually got invited last year, but I had twins. So I've had a kind of crazy year where, a four-year-old and 15-month-old twins in my first year in the job. So it's been pretty punchy. But I'm really looking forward to what I hope will be just a really vibrant exchange of ideas. So I'll sort of throw out a provocation and then leave enough time for us to have a conversation. To sort of ask questions, exchange ideas, and hopefully forge a way forward. So I'm the chief exec of a think tank called the New Economics Foundation. We were set up about 30 years ago, and throughout our 30-year history, we have essentially been arguing that the economy is broken because it does not work for the majority of people, and it does not work for our planet. And in the end, if you want to achieve economic, if you want to achieve environmental justice, you've got to overhaul the economic system and the free market rules, to use the jargon, the neoliberal rules that underpin it. The thing that's been really, really interesting for us as an organization and absolutely fascinating for me personally is that what was a fringe argument, what was an outlier argument for much of our 30-year history is now entering the fore of the political debate and becoming mainstream. So if you cast your mind back to the 2017 general election, pretty much every major political party went into that election saying the economy doesn't work. And they were saying this because they were reflecting a deep sense in the country that the economy is rigged and the system is not on people's side. And that the social contract that has dominated the fabric of our politics since the mid-40s is fraying. That basic promise that if you work hard, if you do the right things, you'll get ahead, and more importantly, your kids will do better than you, that promise is breaking down. And I think people are understandably fed up. I think they're frustrated. I think they're angry, and I think they want change. And for me, you know, that's the lens in which I see the Brexit vote. Now, I wasn't going to mention the B word, but I can't resist. So sorry. But, you know, whether you agree with the Brexit vote or not, what's clear is that in the end, that vote was a call for change. And yes, I think people voted for many reasons. And interesting, the research that we've seen on this says that there was this coalition which a third of people who were voting for their sovereignty, and it was a reaction and a rejection of the European Union, but for a third of people, it was an expression of discontent and frustration with the status quo and a political vote for change. And then there was a third, which it was an anti-immigration vote in response to genuine economic pressures that people are feeling. So, you know, if you take those two thirds, for a chunk of the people that voted to leave, and I would argue, you know, the numbers that were absolutely decisive in shifting it from a leave vote to a remain vote, that historic vote was a call for change. Yes, a slap in the face of the political elite, you know, but it was a clear message from communities that I think had been ignored for too long and had been served poorly by our current system, that they wanted something more, something better than the current political settlement. And the clamour for change is not going to go away. And in fact, I think it's just going to get louder and louder. And for me, the real travesty of the last 3 years is that what should have been a wake-up call, what should have been a pivotal moment for change, has been squandered. So we've had 3 years in which our political class have been consumed with the ins and outs of leaving the European Union, where they've been dogged by infighting, and the domestic agenda, the thing that will drive the change that people so desperately need, has been sidelined. Meanwhile, the disquiet that was there 3 years ago continues to grow, and the demand for something better than the current settlement becomes more entrenched. So in the end, whether we leave the European Union or not, we have to respond to this call for change. And I believe that this will be the defining political issue for the next decade. And our view at NEF is that actually this is not the time for tinkering around the margins. It is not the time for incremental change. This is the time for quite fundamental, and I use the word boldly, radical change to the way that our economy is run. And we would argue that actually the conditions for this sort of change, the kind of change that we've been talking about for 30 years, is taking root. And there are three things that are driving a crisis in our current economic system. And we think that they're going to come together in quite a profound, quite a terrifying way over the next 5 to 10 years to create a perfect storm. But in that storm creates the hope, the chance, the opportunity for change. So the first is economic breakdown, which we're seeing in the most visceral way across the country. It feels like the fallout from the global financial crisis is catching up with us. So a crisis that revealed the shortcomings of the economic system, but actually the pain that we've had in the 10 years after the crisis has shown its fundamental contradictions in stark terms. So it's resulted in a decade in which wages have flatlined. It's the longest period of earning stagnation we've had for about 150 years. And we've got ourselves into this really strange situation where we're told the economy's growing. The facts, the stats tell us the economy's growing, but people are not benefiting from it. Instead, they're being squeezed as the cost of essential things they rely on, housing, energy, transport, grows. We're seeing that many people are having to borrow just to get by, so household debt is at record levels. And we've got 14 million people that are living in poverty in this country. One in three of our children are living in poverty in this country. And at the very time when people needed help the most, our public services, our welfare state has been decimated in the name of austerity. Meanwhile, inequality is on the rise. And for me, there are a handful of stats that I just reach out to that put this in stark terms. So today, the wealthiest 10% of households now own 45% of this country's wealth, while the bottom 50%, so huge chunks of our economy, our population, own just 9% of this wealth. 30 years ago, a typical company chief exec, not a chief exec of a charity like my own, but a typical company chief exec, was paid about 20 times the salary of the average worker. Today, it is nearly 120 times the salary of the average worker. And last year, 1,400 senior managers at the FTSE 100 companies, so this is 0.03% of the total workforce, were paid over $2 billion in total. That's an average about $1.6 million each. And this is at the same time that people are being paid poverty wages. So, you know, my take on this is that this sort of inequality is quite frankly endemic in the current economic system. But I think people were willing to suck it up. They were willing to swallow it up as long as they were doing incrementally better from the status quo. Now, and essentially, the logic of what economists will call trickle-down economics held. As soon as this breaks down, in the way that we've seen over the last 10 years, I think the public tolerance for this sort of inequality hits a buffer in a way that starts to call into question the very model and opens up public appetite and opens up public consent for radical change. So that's the economic breakdown. The second driver is the political crisis, which we are all too familiar with. So this widespread disaffection and this lack of trust in our politicians and our political institutions that is beginning to undermine, or more to the point, which is absolutely undermining our democracy, but that's now spreading beyond politics to a lack of trust in the media, to be fair, in many instances justified, but as well as a sort of lack of trust in businesses, in charities even. And this sense that there is a detached elite that is either unable or unwilling to solve the problems that people face. And the political implosion that we've seen over Brexit, I think, has simply reinforced this. This is now giving space to the rise of white right-wing populism with its politics of divide, its easy solutions that don't really offer proper answers, and which is a threat to those of us who believe in progressive radical change. And then you overlay this with the third driver, which in my view is the most profound, and that is the environmental tipping point that we're at. In the end, the threat to our planet and the impact of environmental degradation is the biggest threat to economic and social justice we will face. And what we're being told by the ecologists is that we are now at a tipping point in the depletion of our natural resources, which will start to bite on people's day-to-day lives in a very real way. And it's not just the climate emergency, where the experts have told us we literally have 12 years to take urgent action to mitigate the worst impacts of climate change. But it's also the wider damage to our environment. It's the fact that we are depleting the Earth's natural resources at 1.5 times its ability to regenerate. By 2025, we're told 2/3 of the world's population could be living under water stress conditions. And at the rate at which we are degrading topsoil, we may only have 60 harvests left. 80% of the world's fisheries are either fully or overexploited. Now, this is scary stuff, which is often put in the too scary to think about or the too difficult to think about box. But we're going to have to start shaking ourselves as a society out of our environmental complacency, whether we are ready to or not. And we're already starting to see the shift in public opinion as climate change now moves up the political agenda and people see it as the number one issue. And so now our politics must respond. So these three things, the economic, the political, the environmental, will come together in the next 10 years and we believe create the conditions to for change. The key question is whether this change will be progressive change or regressive change. And our view is that if it is to be the former, then actually we need progressives to come together as a movement to articulate an alternative and to drive and create momentum for that alternative and be clear about what the route map is to get there. And this is at the heart of the work that we are doing at the New Economics Foundation. So we're absolutely clear, this four-decade-old model, this neoliberal model, is absolutely exhausted. We need new economics that works for people and that works for the planet. And for us, there are six things that sit at the heart of this new economy, the building blocks of an alternative economic system. So, first and foremost, it's got to be an economy that is rooted in a thriving and vibrant environment. In which an urgent green transition is seen as the priority, and which we accept that we have to operate within environmental limits. Second, it's got to be an economy that delivers improvements in well-being and more equal living standards. One in which the basics for a decent quality of life, a minimum income below which no one can fall, housing, healthcare, social care, childcare, education are universal, they're guaranteed for all, and they are provided collectively. Third, it's got to be an economy that is built by progressive businesses who work in the long term, who work in the public interest, where they regain that sense of social purpose that used to be the hallmarks of the best corporations, with stronger voice and power for workers, social and environmental responsibility baked into the business model, social and community interest taking precedence over shareholder interest. Fourth, and critically, it's got to be an economy that gives people ownership and a stake through common ownership of public goods, so our land, our green spaces, our community assets, but also common ownership of essential infrastructure that people rely on day to day. So how we move around, our transport, our water, our energy. And you know, this doesn't mean clunky national bureaucracies running everything from the top. It can be achieved through municipal ownership, through community ownership too. But it also means thinking about cooperative, mutual employee ownership of businesses, of technology, of our assets. Fifth, our view is this economy needs to be supported and stewarded by an active government that is willing to work and intervene to drive social and environmental outcomes, but where significant power is pushed down to strong, decentralized local states that are rooted in communities and shaped and informed by strong democratic participation. And then finally, and possibly most importantly, it has to be an economy where people have more power over the things that affect their day-to-day lives, in which they can act collectively to shape their lot. Now, if these are the building blocks of a different type of economic system, if these are the building blocks of a new economy, then the question is, how do we get there? Is this just utopian pie-in-the-sky thinking, or can it be achieved? Now, our view is that to get there, it requires us to develop radical policies to drive big change and to respond to the big challenges that we face. And to do this, it means thinking about the immediate crises we face, climate emergency, housing, the squeezing on living standards, and thinking about ways in which we can respond and find an answer to these problems, yes, but do it in a way that is catalytic to driving the long-term change that we want to see and creating the stepping stones for a new economy. And I think the Brexit shambles creates a really interesting window. Because yes, Brexit has brought about uncertainty, it's brought about impasse, it's brought about anger, it's brought about division, but it also creates an opportunity for national renewal. So I have no idea what's going to happen in the next 2 months. I've been in politics for a while, and I've never been in the space where you literally can't predict where this is going to end up. So I don't know if we will crash out on October 31st, as our new prime minister keeps telling us. I don't know if we will cobble up some sort of a deal in which we're able to leave on more measured and planned terms, or I don't know whether in the end a second referendum becomes the way out of this mess. But what I do know is that the political debate must move beyond Brexit, and the anger and the rancor that will come about if it doesn't is unthinkable. And at that point, all sides across the political spectrum are going to have to offer a new deal to the country, something akin to a new social settlement that can calm the rancor, that can heal the divide, and can renew the country. And we think that this is a huge opportunity, but for us to seize on that opportunity, it requires a big social movement to start saying, this is the change we want, and to start demanding that change. And for us, we think there are three fundamental pillars that sit, or could sit, at the heart of this social settlement. So, the first is a Green New Deal. Now, this is an idea that was pushed out by NEF about 10 years ago, in collaboration with other partners, was then revived and given a new currency in the US by the Sunrise Movement and AOC, and has come back with a vengeance in the UK as a growing movement led by the youth strikers are now calling for a Green New Deal. The idea is a simple one. It says, look, in order to deal with the climate emergency, we need an unprecedented mobilization of resources, the kind of mobilization of resources that we have never achieved in peacetime. And we need to do this in a way to decarbonize the economy at pace whilst creating jobs and lifting people's living standards. Now, at the heart of this idea of the Green New Deal is a recognition that actually the climate change, the climate emergency, and the wider threat to our environment is a system of this very economic model that is broken. The same economic system that has left millions of people squeezed and given rise to poverty and inequality. So to tackle climate change, you've got to transform the economy. It isn't just an environmental agenda, it's an economic agenda. And so, to do this, we think you've got to get three things absolutely right. First, ambition. So we need to radically decarbonize our economy at pace and at a much, much faster rate than our net zero target by 2050 allows for. Second, it means significant government action from large-scale investment in green infrastructure, in green technology, in green industries, as well as incentives and regulation to bend markets that have been slow to respond to the climate imperative. So for a start, let's ban fossil fuel subsidies and plow it back into renewables. So we're talking about a big fiscal stimulus, and we think that we need to be moving to at least a minimum of 2% of GDP going into driving the green transition, ramping up to 5% of GDP, as well as active monetary policy. So getting the central bank to shift its mandate and see that driving the green transition is as important and is as big of a risk to the economy as anything else. But also taking far more active role in monetary policy. So we talk about credit guidance, where the central bank would essentially put caps and quotas on the amount of investment that the financial markets can put on dirty versus green investment to start shifting the way that the financial markets work. Third, I think in return for consenting to what will be quite a radical change, you know, change in every aspect of how we do things, the food we eat, how we travel, the homes in which we live in, there's got to be a good deal for the public. There's got to be a good deal for people in this. So a promise, yes, to create better jobs where jobs will be lost. And I think we've got to be honest that in parts of the country where we are shifting away from fossil industries, people will lose jobs. And actually, it's the responsibility to think about how we create cleaner, better, greener jobs. But also, it means giving people a stake on the green economy that will emerge. So you will notice a theme: common ownership of green infrastructure and assets. So that state at both the national and the local level getting involved in shaping the way the green industry works, but investing it and putting this back in trust that is owned by all of us. But also cooperative ways of organizing businesses, industries that will spring up in the green economy. So the Green New Deal for us is the first pillar. The second pillar is renewing the social contract to replace the one that has been frayed. First and foremost, that means a better deal for workers. So tackling this issue of wages and the growing power imbalance in the workplace between shareholders and workers. And firstly, thinking about actually, you know, the government has a huge effect on how businesses operate. And yet it doesn't use any of the levers that it has, corporation tax, regulations, incentives, subsidies, in order to try and shift and drive business behavior. So our view is actually use those levers, reward companies that reward their workers fairly and penalize companies that don't. So the first piece, active government policy to try and drive a fairer deal for workers. But this has got to then be supported by strengthening the power of workers in workplaces so they can protect their own interest. So stronger collective bargaining, which has been eroded over the last 20, 30 years, but also mandating businesses to automatically recognize unions and giving workers the time to organize and be active. But for us, that doesn't go far enough. We also need to think about how we create greater ownership of the organizations in which people work, which is why we've been calling for this idea of an employee ownership fund, which would essentially see a share of profits each year transferred over to workers in the form of equity in a worker or stakeholder fund. These shares would come with voting rights in order to give workers a say in the direction of businesses and how they're run. And each year, the share that workers own would grow until we reach a tipping point in which workers own a dominant share of the economy. But you know, it's not just giving returns to workers in the form of wages. It's also their time. And you know, at NEF, we've been long calling for a shorter working week. So our research has shown that actually for most of the post-war period, The average full-time week for work steadily fell from 46 hours to 40 hours. And this was part of a longer-term trend in which we moved from a 7-day working week to a 5-day working week. So the amount of time that we spend in work is not mandated by some natural law. It is a function of the decisions that we make as a society and our willing to shift the balance between work and leisure. And our view is that actually, you know, this trend that we saw in the post-war period then stagnated from the 1980s onwards as the kind of deregulation free market agenda set in, but also the power and the collective bargaining of unions was curtailed. And what we saw is stagnation for the last 30 years. And actually, if we'd continued at the post-war trend, then we would actually be on track, just organically, naturally, through increases in productivity, through regulation, through collective bargaining, we would be on track for a 4-day week, so 30 hours a week, by 2040. So there is a trend that has been bucked that we've got to try and reverse. And so for us, this is in part done by national policy. So one of the things that we are calling for is a working time commission. We're actually an organization, a bit like the kind of low pay commission, looks at changes in the economy, looks at where there have been gains in the economy, and then says, well, we increase statutory holidays as a result. So action at the top, but that's got to be complemented by action on the ground. So industrial campaigns in which unions work, campaign, negotiate for a shorter working week in workplace after workplace after workplace. But that only takes us so far. In addition to a fairer deal for workers in the workplace, we think that it's absolutely critical that actually our state, our government, our society moves us to a place where protecting people's well-being, improving people's well-being becomes a fundamental goal. So we are talking about reconfiguring the welfare state model, which in some respects has reached the bounds of what it can do, and shifting to a well-being state model, one in which actually a minimum income is something that is provided collectively. So everyone, no matter whether you're in work or not in work, particularly in the context of the change that we're going to see with automation, with the green transition, everyone knows that there is a minimum income upon which they cannot fall, so you can provide food for your kids, so you can get from A to B. But in addition, complementing that with universal basic services, funded by progressive taxation, provided communally and collectively. But this would include housing, which should be a basic right. No, it's not something that certain people who can afford it should be able to have a home, and those that don't shouldn't. And actually, that us as a society, ensuring that everyone has access to housing is a basic thing that we should expect to do in an advanced society. So housing, social care, health, education, childcare that is fundamental for the ability for women to participate in the labor market, but fundamentally shapes the life chances of our children. Make that a universal requirement. And then the final pillar is the one to democratize our economy, pushing power and ownership down to people and their communities. So this means rapid and radical devolution of power to nations of this country, as well as to local and regional government. And in return, the deal should be that actually local leaders would look to improve the well-being and the livelihoods of their community by shifting away from this growth-centered model, this idea that if we invest in big infrastructure, if we just grow our economy, people will do better. It doesn't work. We've seen this over the last 10 years. It doesn't work. And moving to one in which it is a well-being-centered economy. And using the procurement, the investment, the commissioning power of the local state to boost local jobs, to support locally owned firms, and to fundamentally change the structure of local economies so that we create the new economy from place to place up until we change the nature of the country. So pump priming worker cooperatives, shifting and pump priming community ownership. And for me, there's a really interesting case study, which is the Mondragon Corporation in the Basque Country, which provides a really powerful insight into how this can be done. So this was set up in 56, to provide local employment through worker cooperatives It survived for 60 years, so it survived through the wanes and the waxes of the economy, and has now become one of the 10 largest business groups and the fourth largest employer in Spain. So 200 different companies and subsidiaries and over 75,000 workers. And I think there's also the space, not just for the local state to be active in shifting the nature of the economy, but for it to take an active role in providing the things I talk about, the basic infrastructure that we need. So municipal transport, municipal energy, municipal water, through municipal corporations that are accountable to local people. So three pillars. Three ideas, three pillars of a potential new social contract. And there are many more ideas where this came from. But you know, for me, it's not just about new ideas. And organizations like us, we trade on coming up with things. We've done this for 30 years and we'll do it for 20 years more or 30 years more until hopefully we achieve the new economy and we become redundant. But you know, it's about how we create these ideas and how we do things in a different way. So for us, a new economics of people and planet must be led by those that are experiencing the ill effects of the old economy most acutely. So our starting point in all of this is that we've got to start with communities. We've got to work with people who are at the sharp end of fighting against a system that is broken, to develop solutions that work and put the new economics in practice. And there are examples, amazing examples of this up and down the country. So whether it's in Derbyshire villages where we've worked fighting plans for fracking their countryside, or families in Deptford that have come together to create parent-led cooperative childcare, or organizers or employees that are already organizing their businesses in a different way, community land trusts that are buying up land, providing affordable housing that they're holding in trust for their people locally. All examples of people shifting wealth and power in a way that is starting to chip away at the old system. And we believe that if you can tap into this energy, this insight, the innovation, the desire for change, and build a social movement that can demand this change, that can ask for something better than what we currently have, and create momentum for this change. I know we've seen this over the last 6 months, where the energy, the focus of Extinction Rebellion, the youth strikers, has put climate change back at the top of the political agenda, so it can be done. But if we can mobilize this social movement to demand for a new social settlement coming out of whatever we end up getting to with Brexit, then maybe, just maybe, we can begin to unleash the sort of change that I think so many of us in this room want to see, and perhaps, just perhaps, start creating the stepping stones towards a new economy. Thank you.
Miatta, that was so full of wisdom and of hope that we will forgive you for talking about Brexit. Thank you. I know you're eager to have a conversation with those of us in the room about this. So myself and Michael have two roving microphones. Does anyone have a question to kick us off with? Can I start with you?
You mentioned that we have no way of predicting what's going to happen with Brexit. What do you as an organisation think is the ideal outcome?
Very good. This is where I get in trouble. Okay, so look, there's a kind of, there's a personal view and an organisational view. I'll start with the personal view and I'll talk, and then I'll say something about the organisational view. You know, I'm not of the generation that I think, you know, that I don't see myself as a European. I do. I see myself as, you know, someone from Britain. I also see myself as someone from European Union. I believe that we are stronger in a really volatile and dangerous global world together with countries that share our values. You know, so I think about the Scandinavian countries that are much closer to some of the things that we talk about. And I would much rather us be closer to them than the US, quite frankly, which is the sort of system we're moving towards. So that's a personal view. And in that, therefore, I think this is madness. So that's my personal view. As an organization, because we're a charity, we can't be political and quite so strident, we try to take an objective view. And so we thought about this. And, you know, for us, there are two things. What we care about is radical change of the economy. And for us, that is about domestic policy. There is very little that we believe being in the EU constrains us by doing that. What worries us is that not only will Brexit have a short-term impact on people, so we've seen all that, you know, yes, there are economists that say somehow it's going to be sunny uplands, but the majority of credible economists, including the economists in my organisation, actually think it's going to have a huge impact on people. And it won't be, you know, the small proportion of people who are relatively well off that will be hit by it. It'll be communities who, by the way, have been under huge pressure for 10 years, therefore don't have the resilience to have another knock that will really feel the pain. So yes, there's a short-term impact that then makes you think, why would we do this? But for me, the real clincher is if we leave, definitely if we leave on no deal, but even if we leave in a measured way, if there's such a thing, then we basically spend 10 years obsessing and trying to deal with Brexit. We spend 10 years where all the energy of our politicians, all the energy of our civil service, the amount of civil service time that has gone into Brexit, rather than housing, rather than living standards, is an absolute scandal. So my worry is that we have 10 years where we should be dealing with the issues I've been talking about. We should be thinking about the climate emergency. We should be thinking about how we deal with the living standards crisis, that we're dealing with this thing that is a distraction that will not make people's lives better. So our view in the end is we've got ourselves into this mess, but if what we cared about was changing the lot and improving the lot of people in this country, this is not the answer to that.
My question is as follows, and it's to do with growth. And I'm wondering how you convince people to go for a well-being economy as opposed to a growth economy, when that would mean that they're not going to be gaining anything in themselves. And if there are that many people who were disenfranchised and marginalised sufficiently to vote against remaining in the EU, I'm wondering how you convince those people that they shouldn't get better off.
Yeah. So that's a really good question. And that's something that, you know, this question of growth or not growth, I think, is fundamental, and it's something that we sort of have been grappling with as an organisation. I think I'd say sort of three things on that. One, not growing is not the same as people's well-being being improved. And actually, if you think about the disbalance in our economy at the moment, where the gains are being captured so starkly by a small proportion of the population, even within the constraints of how big the economy is at the moment, we could do much better to improve people's well-being. It means redistributing, it means some people losing out, but we could do much better. So I think that's the first thing I'd say. I think the second thing I'd say is, actually, that was always quite a hard sell, because growth has been so baked into the psyche of everything. It's taught to economists like myself from day one. It's in everything we do, how we think about public policy. And so it has been a hard sell for a really long time. I think the thing that's now changing and the thing that creates the window and an opportunity is that for a long time, growth essentially tracked improvements in living standards. And it was always, you know, GDP was only ever supposed to be a proxy for living standards. And so you could talk about that because actually we were talking about people's living standards. Well, that hasn't happened. 10 years, that hasn't happened. The link between growth and people being better off has broken down. So actually, what is the point of pursuing growth if it's not benefiting people? And I think that's where the debate has shifted that makes it easier. So, you know, we don't have to grow this thing. We just need to do it better. And we need to redistribute better so that the gains are shared more equally. And then I think the final thing I'd say is we've got to absolutely shift the way that we work in order to exist within environmental limits. And my view is that technology can play a huge role there because it means that we can live better, sustainable, healthy, happy lives by applying technology in a way that allows us to do things differently. But there's no incentive in the system for us to do that. We're not channeling technological know-how into actually how we live sustainable, better lives because we don't have to. Unless there's a pivot and change so that those that are doing the innovation are trying to apply it to, well, how do we live within the envelope that we have, but live and do better? And also then share it better, we're not going to have that change. Which is why I go back to the need to shift the political frame for a social movement that absolutely needs to be demanding something better than what we have.
Thank you. Miata, can we take a bunch of three questions now? Is that okay? We'll start with the person who's got the microphone over there.
All right. I'm in the very privileged position of just starting to work for an elected mayor of the north of Tyne, who has a manifesto commitment to developing a cooperative and regionally a regional bank that's cooperatively owned. You talked about the need for a mass social movement. I wondered if you could respond to how you see the democratisation of our banking industry as being part of that social movement.
Very good.
So the question I've got is this. I like what you've done with the Green New Deal, but can I answer two challenges to what you've just set out in relation to industrial democracy? So I'm a workplace union organizer, and I've was elected three times to the national executive of my union. And I like what you've proposed in terms of industrial democracy, but the challenges are this. John McDonnell, the shadow chancellor, has adopted at least two of the policies that you've outlined in principle. One is to give, for companies with over 250 employees, an annual £500 share dividend or bonus, if you like.
He didn't go as far as we wanted him to.
Yeah, so it's a first step. The second, however, is to for the state to take 10% of the profits of every company over 250 employees and for the state to take that. Now, we're already seeing a national investment strike by investors in the UK. They're paying out record dividends in the second quarter of this year. We're heading towards record national dividends at the end of the financial year. With those two proposals, what is to stop investors from carrying on striking, i.e. they're paying out dividends and they're paying out massive share bonuses and huge levels of pay to their directors as well. So how are you going to stop capital from simply moving to other investment opportunities overseas? So what I'm saying is that what you're putting forward is impractical.
Great, thank you.
You've explained very cogently, sorry, I'm over here, behind you. You've explained very cogently how that your six building blocks that you've outlined are interconnected and interrelated in bringing about the radical economic change. But one of the things that we know is that simple messages have more traction. Mm. And communicating complexity, especially on a mass scale rather than in one-to-one deep conversation, is really hard. And to bring this about, it seems that this is one of the big challenges because, yes, you've said you're sort of speaking to the converted here today, but you've also commented on the motivations for the Brexit vote and that sort of thing. So I wondered if you could maybe just comment on how we can be more effective in that sort of mass communication of really complex interrelated issues. Thanks.
Thank you. Fantastic. Three brilliant questions. let's hope I remember them all. The financial markets and the role of kind of cooperative banks within this. So we think it's a really critical role. And I think there are sort of three layers by which I'd sort of see it. So there's one, what the central bank can do, which is what I've touched on. And then I think the second, which is an idea that we've been calling for a very long time, is this idea of regional banks. Our view was RBS was a huge opportunity because we could have just broken up RBS and actually had it as a kind of regional banking structure to try and prime local banks. And then the local banking structure, which is what Jamie's talking about. Interestingly, it's been muted in Bristol. It's been muted in other parts of the country. And I think it's absolutely critical. So what we know from the facts is that if we look at the banking sector, we look at where finance is going. I think it's something like over 90% of finance is flowing into essentially the financial sector. So it's flowing into property and it's flowing into the insurance industry. It's not flowing into the real economy. So we know there's a blockage. And one of the big frustrations over the last 10 years has been, we have created money and pump primed the financial sector, and none of that has found its way back into the regional economy, into actual the real economy. SMEs that essentially account for huge amounts of people that are employed and a huge share of our business base only get about 3% of finance that's flowing from the financial sector. So you've got to break the model. Now, the difficulty, and that in part speaks to the kind of the flight of capital, is that it's global. And it's very, very hard for any domestic government to try and do this. So what you do is you create challenges. and actually creating regional banks by, you know, for example, shifting RBS, which is what we would argue, into a kind of publicly owned bank, but also creating local bank. You create a challenger. If you're not going to do it, we'll do it, because there is a market there. And actually, we'll use the kind of the power and the balance sheet of the state in order to pump investment into parts of the economy that we need to. And if we do that, then actually it forces, you know, people talk about competitive markets. We don't have competitive markets. That's part of the problem. So create challenges that are owned, that are working in our public and community interests to create that competition. And we'll probably see a flight of capital, but I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing once we put the infrastructure in place. So for me, it's a really part of, if you imagine the national, the regional, the local, it's a really important part of that tapestry. And I'd desperate to see other areas taking the lead of, you know, Northern Tyne and Jamie. I was saying, we're going to do this because it's absolutely important. Your really, really, really important challenge, and I spend quite a lot of time talking to businesses, talking to the CBI, talking to others, so I'm hearing this challenge quite a lot. And let me say two things. So one thing, the Labour proposal is not our proposal, and my view is that the Labour proposal has probably got two things wrong. By capping the share that goes to employers, we think that's a mistake. But also transferring a share into a social dividend. Now, I understand what they did it, which is that you're going to get certain industries, so finance and banking, where actually the share that would go to workers is huge. And then you might get other industries like retail, where it's tiny. So you hoover up centrally in order to redistribute and invest in social returns. That's the idea. The difficulty with that is that it shifts it from being a model that was fundamentally trying to shift and drive ownership, which for us is the key, to something that just feels akin to taxation, which is why I think those that are challenging it have some grounds. Now, I think in answer to the specific proposal about employee ownership, I think I'd say two things. So, firstly, the truth is the majority of companies in this country are grounded companies. They're companies that are based here and they're not about to move away. And actually shifting employee ownership models within that is perfectly possible without seeing the flight of capital. I think the second thing I'd say is that employee ownership is not just a good to have because we care about workers. The evidence that we're seeing, and yes, it's not big enough in order to have to be able to say it definitively, but companies that have shifted to employee-owned models, which is why you're seeing a lot of companies like Richard Sounds doing it voluntarily, have shown that it leads to higher productivity, better staff retention, it leads to better business performance. So our argument is that it not only generates the benefit that we care about for workers, it not only does the job of rebalancing the power dynamics within the labor market, but it's fundamentally good for business. And actually, if you put it like that, then actually you can move with your feet, but if you just do it based on business performance, it will yield positive results. So I think there is a challenge in the labor proposal that's unfortunately given them a little bit of a kind of own goal, in my view, which we could have avoided, because I think when you talk about employee ownership, and what was really interesting, when John McDonald announced it, no one actually criticised the employee ownership component. And when we polled it, it was hugely popular with the public. So everything everyone's gone with is a social dividend. Well, this is the taxation. What is this? Well, the actual principle of people who work, who know, who understand their companies, having a stake and a share is actually common sense. It's quite intuitive. And if it means that businesses perform better, what's not to like? So your final question, yeah. So that's a big challenge. And I think the challenge for, and we're grappling with this because those on the right, and I don't never use, because I didn't think this is a left or right debate, but I'll just to characterize, those on the right have a really, they're able to sort of create very simple messages that appeal. Take back control, appeals, it's simple. Those on the progressive side, we tend to get weighted in the complexity and the difficulties, and we talk with head and not with heart, and that's a huge problem. And so I think there's definitely the need to shift the debate. Amongst the converted, amongst friends, we will talk about the complexities. But for me, I think the real window is all of this stuff is quite intuitive now. You know, people, they see it in their lives, they see it in their families, they see it in their communities. You don't have to push a hard sell to say this thing isn't working. People know it, they see it. So if we can tap into that and say, two things. It doesn't have to be this way. So we did a really interesting bit of work where we essentially looked at what people thought about the economy. And we did a huge exercise where we talked to lots of people, did lots of polling. And there were some really interesting messages that came out. So people see the economy as this thing that's sort of done onto them, this thing that has a life of its own that can't be controlled and that they have no agency over. And rather than thinking, how do we change it? It creates a sense of apathy and powerlessness. And so one of the first things that we can do is say, all the economy is the interaction of all of us in this place. So we have the power to change it, but we have to feel that we can change it. So creating that sense of agency, but also that sense that it doesn't have to be this way. It hasn't always been this way, and we can change it, I think are two of the really like most important things that we can do. And if ever there was a time when actually, I think for most people, they're like, yeah, it smells rotten. This is not right. It shouldn't be this way. You can't have people earning on average 1.6 million and people earning barely the minimum wage. That doesn't feel right. And if you have that, you combine it with a sense that actually the economy is a facet of society. It is about what we value. It's about what we care about. It's about how we choose to interact and behave. And you know what? If we all come together and we make our voices heard and we put political pressure, it can be changed. And I think if we can talk in those terms and, you know, talk about the kinds of lives that we get out of it, then perhaps we move it from it being an intellectual exercise to an emotional, a political, a social exercise.
Thank you. We've got time for three more questions, starting with someone up with the microphone over there.
Thank you. You've given us the alarming statistic that 1 in 3 children in this country is living in poverty. We're told that we are the 6th richest country in the world. In the light of what you've said about the financial markets, what would you agree with that statistic? What do you think?
Hiya. So I should start with an admission that I'm one of the civil servants who spent the last 2 years worrying about Brexit rather than doing
Very
any work
good.
On social policy. So I just wanted to ask briefly about international trade, which is what I'm working on at the moment. So it seems that you've spoken about some quite inspiring things about our domestic economy, but that those might come with a bit of tighter regulation, perhaps around things like focusing on, you know, the green economy rather than purely on kind of growth and profits. And I suppose, you know, trade has been a big part of us linking ourselves with other nations and cooperating on all sorts of issues. And that includes things like climate change, I think, really importantly. Yeah. So I'm just interested in whether inevitably protecting our own businesses to be able to focus on social reform and, you know, workers' rights and things means inevitably kind of putting up barriers to international trade. Or is there a kind of neater solution that lets us have best of both worlds?
Thank you. Hi, I'm behind you. In true pantomime fashion, I'll wave at you. So I'm a pantomime baddie. I'm actually a business owner, and I think I earn about 1.3 times my lowest paid employee. So I haven't got any more money. But my question is about leadership and change, because my experience of leadership is I drive businesses forward around my values and I run my businesses around my values. And I feel, you know, as a Christian, sorry for the sermon, I make my choices to live out my values in my work. So how are we going to bring about the change in the values of the leaders who will bring about the change you're talking about?
Very good. Very good. So international trade, the first question, children, yes. So it's a paradox, and that's a problem. Yes, we are the 5th richest country, but we're also hugely unequal. So we can be incredibly rich and it's just shared disproportionately, which is why we've ended up where we have. And which is why I go back to, we have to start valuing success in a different way. It's not enough to have huge GDP if it doesn't matter. And so there has to be a shift, but that shift's only going to come when we say, you know, so when our chancellor stands up and says, oh, great, you know, record GDP levels, we say, well, so what? What does that mean for living standards in this part of the country? What does that mean for in that other part of the country? And if you can't answer that, then you failed. It's not good enough just to grow. People have to do better, living standards have to improve, and we cannot have a situation where a third of our kids literally are living in poverty. And what's so shocking is that the majority of those are with parents that are working. So working poverty is now a thing. You know, so for a long time, the retort was, oh, well, you know, people, if you don't work, what do you expect? People are working. They're working multiple jobs. They're still poor. There is something fundamentally wrong with that. And that's a value piece. That's a social piece. And I think we just have to call it out. And we just got to demand better. I think your point on international trade is a really, really important one. And, you know, I'm an internationalist. I think the thing that's really interesting, so I was talking with a sort of set of the kind of Nordic countries. And even amongst the sort of Scandinavian, the Nordic countries, who are in, you know, many respects ahead of us, because they've had a model of social democracy, unlike our kind of free market model that's provided some protection, their sense is that all the trends that we're seeing, so wage stagnation, growth not benefiting the majority of people, growing kind of social fragmentation, frustration, it's playing out. We're seeing it in the US. Now, Trump, unfortunately, was a response to that. But what sits behind it is a social discontent that we would argue is fundamentally linked to the economic model. So, yes, there's an agenda that we've got to spearhead here, but I don't think it's a UK-only agenda, you know, and what we argue is that because in some ways us, like the US, went for the most aggressive version of the kind of neoliberal project in the 1980s, our European counterparts tempered it by maintaining some of the social democratic traditions that we used to have and we eroded, we're further along the cycle of decline. But everyone is moving there because fundamentally the system is meeting the bounds of its contradictions. And we're seeing that climate change, which is not a domestic, it's a global issue. So I think there is a move towards this. I would say that, obviously. But I think there is a move towards this. So yes, we've got to light a flame and drive change here now, but it's got to be part of a global conversation. And if the sort of social justice agenda isn't the thing that drives it, the climate agenda will drive it. So for, you know, the gentleman that said the flight of capital, where are they going to go to when everyone is facing the same problems and they're forced to change? So I think we're in the cusp of a kind of a medium-term change that's going to move across the globe. So increasingly international trade, the kind of collaboration we have with other countries in order to drive good globally, I think is going to take a different frame and dimension, which is why, you know, I go back to Europe and, you know, many of my colleagues will say, well, you know, the European Union has been a bastion of neoliberalism. And I say, well, by the way, it was the UK that kind of drove it within the European Union, and many countries chose not to go down that path. But, you know, through that sort of cooperation, imagine if we had this sort of conversation at European level, where actually the European state was trying to drive some of this change, and then the impact that would then have in the global conversation. So I think there has to be a kind of a filtering, and I think there will be, just because I think just conditions will demand it in the end. And then the final, the very inspiring gentleman. So I think you're completely right. And there are so many amazing business leaders and other leaders that fundamentally are living by their values, and they're running their companies like by their values. And I think there is a really interesting piece. So, you know, one of the bit that we're thinking about is actually, can we pull together some progressive business leaders that say, the old model is sort of broken, and it's not just broken because of social grounds, it's actually broken on economic grounds. Because if you lose public consent to operate, to license, it makes it impossible to do business in a proper way. So we need leaders that see that we need to do things differently. And there are lots of examples of business leaders that are already doing some of the things that I've talked about, or already trying to create it within their working and corporate culture, to be at the fore of saying, this has to be the new norm, and driving that shift in conversation. And our hope is actually the lessons that we've learned when we've thought about kind of business change and transformation is if you can get a critical mass that then become an exemplar, that then starts to shift business culture. And then you just give it a bit of a nudge by, you know, some regulations, some policies, some incentives. And that's the thing that that moves it. But I agree, shifting the values of our leaders is absolutely important. In the end, I probably take quite a political view on this. I think some will reach down and do it naturally. Others will have to be forced to do it. And that requires those that are located within that values, those that believe that we need to do something differently, to come together, to fight for it, to demand for it, to sort of create momentum for that change. And what I find, I think the final thing, the thing I find fascinating is, And the reason I say this is not a left and right agenda, really isn't, is it's just common sense. You poll a lot of this stuff and people are like, yeah, of course. Of course we should have an economy where everyone does better off. Of course we shouldn't have gaping levels of inequality. Of course we should have a stake. Of course our utility should be owned and work in our interests. Like, none of this stuff is actually that radical. It's not in the spectre of the left or anything. It is now just a mainstream common sense. And we need the political will to actually catch up with where I think the public are.
Thank you for listening to Great Thinking, Ideas and Conversations from Greenbelt. At Greenbelt, we make a space where artistry meets activism, where the political meets the practical, where the sacred meets the secular. We think we're somewhere to dream up a better world, to dance and debate, to pray and to party. Visit greenbelt.org.uk to browse and download other great thinking from our recorded catalogue. We're Greenbelt. We're somewhere to believe in.